Welcome to the Traveling Teams Media Ministry. To find out more, visit www.thetravelingteam.org.
We're going to look at China's harvestable cities tonight is what we're going to look at. And then toward the end, we're going to take this as a case study, and I'm going to talk to you some about mobilization. Because one of my favorite things, I've never intended to mobilize, but God seems to use me that way, and so I enjoy that part. And we have just in the last 10 years really entered another era of mission, and it's requiring some new skills, some new understandings for mobilizers. In fact, they're playing a whole different role in the kingdom. And so I want you to just kind of hear from some things that we're learning about that, because I know that most of you will be mobilizing, and when you go back, and especially if you join the traveling team. So I would like to just pause for a moment to pray, and as we do, I want you just to reflect on the fact that about out of every 4 to 5 people on earth is Chinese. Okay? So if we just kind of went through, some people say 1 out of every 4, others say 1 out of every 5. So let's just say it's 1 out of every 5. You do 1, 2, 3, 4 Chinese, and then we could just go around the world. So the things we're talking about tonight have incredible implications for you, for your children, for your grandchildren, in terms of the way that the world is going to operate in a few years. So we're not talking about just any group. We're talking about something that's pretty significant. So let's pray together. Father, we come to you tonight. We just say thank you. We say thank you because you have tracked us down when many of us were running away from you. And you have sought us, you have wooed us to yourself, and Lord, you then bring us on your team to be a part of the continual message that must flow to the very ends of the earth. Lord, we're very aware that the evil one, all of the emphasis is to block the incredible message of salvation, of restoration, of returning things to their right state, the way that you designed it. And so he is at war. It's easy for us, Lord, to think about war in Iraq or war in some other place that we hear about in the nightly news, but because this war is in the invisible places, sometimes it escapes our notice. And so, Lord, I pray that as we talk about China tonight, that we would see it in the context of the way that you do. There has been incredible deception and blockage there. And yet, Lord, people that you have created cry out and they have hungered for you. And we just see in it such an amazing move of your spirit in that place. And so, Lord, just give us understanding. Give us eyes to see the way that you do. And Lord, I pray that then you would bring that back on us in terms of the implications for our own personal lives, our choices, our giving, our going, our conversations, our reading of newspapers, our listening to the nightly news. Lord, would you instruct us deep within our spirits that we might be more truly yours than ever. And so, Lord, we just love you. We commit this time to you and say thank you. In your name I pray. Amen. Coloring a destiny. Had you ever think of yourself as really being able to affect much in terms of, most of us don't even feel like we affect our own very well, and yet the global destiny. And yet, all through history, there have been those few believers who have stood for something or who have had a cause, who understood something, and by a single person's action, it has changed destiny, not only of families, but of cities, of nations, and of our world. And so we want to learn from some of that. But coloring a destiny, we're going to look at China's harvestable cities. Is there anything that we can do about that? Let me just make a couple of statements as we begin, because the most overarching thing about China today, the most overarching thing that has implications for us in terms of world evangelization, is this one factor. And later in our talking, I'm going to explain a little bit more about it, but let me just make this statement first. The biggest shift right now in China is that it is becoming an urban nation. It's the cities. They had so few cities a few years ago. In fact, with the revolution, what was intended, they moved people out of the cities to the rural areas to get control, to get power. so that they could have people in smaller places that could be watched more carefully. And yet today, within the last 5 years, there's been an incredible decision and move back to the cities. And when China government decides to do anything, they do it. In fact, on today's news, if you have any kind of opportunity to grab a channel program anywhere, on CNN, they had interviews with a reporter that was going into a city that the Chinese government told him didn't exist. Oh, no, we've already torn that city down. There's no one left there. We've already moved them to the big cities. And yet he found a taxi driver that would take him, and sure enough, and so they were interviewing the actual people there and kind of understanding the grassroots people and how, even though the government is mandating they move to these cities, they don't have the funds. Supposedly the government moves them, but that's not true. And when they interviewed different ones, so it is an unbelievable shift that is going on. I want to just deal with one aspect of that shift. There are so many that are affecting the billion, 0.3 Chinese in China. But this was a study from the Chinese Red Cross. But because of the shift to the urban centers, China is going through an incredible rapid shift from rural to urban. And it's the kind of period that we like to think of, if you deal with mission strategy at all, as an opportune season in China. They are actually open now to an entire worldview shift in ways that they haven't been before. The Chinese Red Cross actually reports that they did a study on just 16 of the Chinese cities, and they discovered that 1 million, I mean, these were cities of over a million, excuse me, and they have found that in those 16 cities of over a million, 75%+ of the Chinese suffer from ill health. The life expectancies are declining now that they're moving people to cities, and particularly for skilled and educated workers. They say they define illness as causing reduced levels of energy and fitness, but with no specific diagnosis of disease. So it's not necessarily, you know, disease in the early stages. But they are saying, the Chinese Red Cross says, it's because of bad working habits, poor disease prevention, and inadequate government funding and lack of health education. Now, there's some other implications to that, but I'll deal with that in just a moment. And most of you know that China has been really developing economically in the last few years. But this finding now illustrates the darker side of their economic development, their economic success story. This deteriorating public health. Let me give you some of the stats. I actually brought them so that I could give you facts. It is worst among senior and mid-level managers and well-educated white-collar workers. 75% of Beijing residents were in poor health. 73% of those in Shanghai. 73% in southern city of Guangzhou. The Chinese Academy of Sciences reports that the average lifespan of an educated person is 58 years old, more than 10 years lower than the national average of 72. So of urban workers in the, you know, the professions, it's more than 10 years lower, the average lifespan, than it is for the rest of the Chinese. The official news agency did a study of 380,000 information technology people in the Silicon Valley of Beijing, and they found that their life expectancy is only 53 years now, and it's 5 years less than it was 10 years ago. So it is rapidly declining. And I don't know about you, but I don't think I'd want to be a technology worker in the Silicon Valley of Beijing. But they've cited the rising rates of lung cancer, cardiovascular illness, respiratory illness, and strokes. Almost all of those are related to stress and unsolved issues, you know. But government officials or government figures show that economic losses from disease in China right now is $170 billion a year. That's lost work, lost revenues from just illness. Now, when you look at it from a mission strategist point, in other words, as God has called us to reach all nations, one of the things that we can know for sure is that China is more open. It is more open to a brand new way to look at things. They're looking for answers. You can't have that kind of percentage, 75%, in an area that have declining health and lowering life expectancies, and there not be some questions beginning to rise. some anxieties beginning to rise. Those are the kinds of things that create openness. They're the kinds of things that create a receptivity, a harvestability. And so this is just one of the areas, again, and it's all specifically related to the shift now to the urban centers, which I hope we'll understand a little bit more about. Because right now what's happening is in the cities there is emptiness, there is a vacuum. In other words, they did have something, now they don't. They're in new areas and don't have a clue. And so there's this vacuum that creates harvestability. Let's look at some things about China in general. For God so loved the Chinese that he created a great many of them. Right now, as I mentioned, we have a huge percentage of the world's population. Many commodities and even the clothing around the world often have the label made in China. I would dare say that probably at least a quarter of you have that label, and maybe up to three quarters of you have that label in your clothing right now. 22% of the Earth's population is Chinese. That's the low. I took the low percentage estimate. Some say it's a little more than 25%. Dr. Randy Kluver, who works at a Singapore university and who's also a very committed believer, has said that as he looks at these kind of things, because he is a China expert and writes in many journals and things, he says, will we see God's hand at this historical hinge of history and hear his voice calling his people to move with haste through the opening doors for his glory and grace to flow throughout the Middle Kingdom? You've heard it called the Middle Kingdom. That's because the Chinese feel like they're the center of the earth. Even their Chinese character shows them at the center. And so that's their self-image. China, bustling cities. Many predict and most fully expect, and when I'm saying many predict and most fully expect, I'm not talking about Christians. I'm talking about those that are looking at the world and the shape of that the world is going. That the 21st century to be the China century. You can read it in magazines, you can read it on the web, but most fully expect this to be the China century. It will be leading in economic, military, and political power. Now, I have a question that has always been pretty important for me. I've come to the conclusion that I don't want a quarter of the world's population to have all the military, economic, and political power with the worldview they currently hold. I want you to think about that, because life is cheap, everything's for the government, and if they're in control of our world economically, politically, and militarily, you and I and our children are dead meat in a few years with the worldview they currently hold. And yet God has given us this season. China is full of cities. How many cities of over a million do you think America has? I've seen estimates that show it's anywhere from 9 to 11, and I don't know just exactly what it is right at the moment, and I don't know how many might have reached that in the last few months, but somewhere in that area. Well, China has 180-plus cities that are over a million people. 180-plus. Let's look at China in our globalized world. I want to deal with really four things here. I want to deal with the global forces that push in on China. I want to deal with the global connections they have, global vulnerabilities, and the global language. But I want us to put it in the context of China. The global forces, that means that there are forces begin to shape cultural trends or culture shifts. That might be a better way. There's forces that are beyond any of us, and they begin to force cultural shifts. And cultural shifts means there's a changing values within cultures. And the cultural shift then leads to trends that we see. And so many times as believers, we're just operating on trends. We're just trying to catch the next trend, the next wave. We will miss everything in terms of long-term sustainability and impact if we don't understand that there are global forces that are beyond anything that really begin to push cultural shifts. And only the cultural shifts lead to the trends that we then experience. And so global forces, let me just mention four of them. They're probably the main four. Globalization is one. We'll take these one at a time in just a moment. Urbanization, the internet, and informationization. Those are some forces that are outside anyone's control, and they are pushing things. Globalization. Let me give you a definition that's from magazine that I feel like has helped me to just kind of put it into a context. Globalization is actually the spread of culture and ideas. It's complex forces that are driving the integration of ideas, people, and economics worldwide, not just in one country, but worldwide. There seems to be a consensus about globalization that whether it's economic, political, cultural, or environmental, it's defined by increasing levels of interdependence over vast distances. That's the Foreign Policy magazine. Now, so you begin to understand globalization. It's this integration of all these kinds of things, and it's pushing, it's moving, and it creates dependence. Now, see, we like, as American, powerful America, to be independent. We want all our own energy. We want all our own everything. But actually, in a globalized world, everybody's dependent on everybody else. See, you think you have an American dollar bill in your pocketbook, don't you? In your wallet or your purse? And I just want to tell you, it's no longer an American dollar bill. It is issued by the American government, but it is a global currency today. Because if somebody ups the price of oil like they did on Monday to over $60 a barrel, it affects how many of those dollar bills you have to put in your gas tank. If the baht falls in some country, it begins to have a global domino effect. Everything is affecting everything else. So that's the kind of world we're living in. So China, who has always been so self-contained and so really impenetrable borders, where their people were contained and they didn't know what was going on in the rest of the world for so many years, it's absolutely impossible for them to live that way today. So in the globalized world, there are changing values. So in other words, where China was 15, 20 years ago in terms of value system for their people, for families, for economics, all of that has shifted. They have become a capitalist nation, and yet it's the only capitalist nation that's dominated by a communist government. So again, the whole world's learning new things right now. But they decided, and they did it slowly. They didn't do it like Russia, where Russia just did it very fast and a lot of things collapsed. China has really been in control the whole time, and they've let it happen slowly. There's still a lot of angst around the world with economists, and everybody around the world knows right now they're really concerned about China because their economic development is not sustainable because it doesn't have anything to back it up. And so they feel like they're moving at too fast of a pace. And if China goes down in the next year or two, it's going to affect all of us. And it will affect us far more negatively than the American dollar moving downward. So they have an inflated housing market. Talk about bubbles. China's full of the economic bubbles. And so these changing values, the global forces, have been there. Urbanization is another key force around the world. Not just happening in China, it's happening everywhere. When we started the year 1900, only 6% of the world's population lived in urban centers. And today, well over 50% do. And if you haven't noticed, urban people are not like rural people, and rural people are not like urban people. And the first century church was an urban church, but since that time it's gone rural. And we've been effective all over the world in rural areas, and we've been very ineffective in the urban areas. Very little sustainable evangelism in the urban centers. So that's not our expertise, and yet over half the world now lives in urban centers. So urbanization is a force. Like I've mentioned, China has moved their people to urban centers to get economic development because in a global world. So now they are following that trend also. Urban centers just have a whole different set of complexity. They have a different set of problems. It's where everything centers, the poor and the wealthy and the power. And so all of the center of a nation is consolidated in the urban centers. And so you have far more consolidated power now, and things that can be scary if they're used the wrong way. The other thing is, of course, the internet, and I don't need to mention much about that. You kind of grew up with it. But the internet, there's nothing safe anymore, and there is a speed that would make my grandmother dizzy. So it almost makes me dizzy. And informationization, you say, well, how is that different than the internet? Informationization is basically the embedding of information in technology. In other words, how many computers are on your car? You know, information is embedded there. If you're in an accident, it tells how fast you were going when that accident happened. There's information embedded everywhere now. It's embedded in medications. We are in some, in other words, you almost think you're in a time warp or something, and that you're in a movie when you really hear about some things that are done with medications now. There's information in there that takes them to certain parts of certain organs, and they feel like within just a few years they'll be able to give you something that goes to that organ and actually reconfigures it, actually changes it physically. It will repair things. Information is embedded in all kinds of things now that we don't even realize. It's not just, you know, your checkbook or your credit card, but it's in all sorts of things. They're talking about embedding things under your skin. So all the information is with you. So this informationization of the world is changing literally the way that we live life on planet Earth. So the global forces, those are the four key ones that I see. Then global connections, there is emerging power because literally of the connections. As I was coming tonight, I was listening to some commentaries on the president's speech last night and all sorts of, you know, other things that are wrangling. And this emerging power that comes from literally the connectedness. And so there was all kinds of discussion on whether it was, you know, who Saddam was connected to and who Al-Qaeda is connected to and who's doing what. And it's these connections many times that are quite invisible, and it doesn't even take a whole nation agreeing with a nation. It might just be one person that has the right connection that gets something in. So it no longer has to be even official. But the global connections are there literally around the world. So whether it's economics, or 2 years ago, how many short-term trips were shut down because of SARS? How many conferences globally among the professionals were shut down because of SARS? How much did it inconvenience the travelers? I mean, I was in places where they would, you'd have a whole bunch of people come off the plane with their mask on. They would herd them all to one room. I mean, it was a wild time, and they were coming from all over the world. I was in a hospital last October just for some testing in Thailand, and literally people were there from just about every country. It was an international hospital, internationally acclaimed, and doctors there were there from all over the world. They were collaborating on cases, an amazing kind of world in which we live. But economically, it might be disease-wise, it could be education-wise. For instance, today, a scientist in Beijing, China, has more in common with a scientist in America or Latin America or Europe or South America or South Korea than they do someone who speaks their language, lives in their community, looks like them, and eats what they do for breakfast. They'll have more in common with these scientists around the world. Why? They are actually dealing with global issues. And so as they connect to that, this global connections, you cannot avoid it, and it changes everything. And there's an emerging power in that that's not based in nations. In fact, the geopolitical kind of power will be far less in a few years than anything we can imagine, because the power will be within companies, within educational institutions, power will be located other places. And the wars will be a different kind of war. Then we are all actually globally vulnerable. And China is globally vulnerable. We have common issues that we're dealing with. We are vulnerable, and see, we know it is American since 9/11. But we did not understand it before. But we've always been globally vulnerable, but even more so today. Ecologically, economically, politically, physically, there, and we could go on and on. We are very vulnerable. We're being held by thin threads. Almost anything, an event, some capture of certain people's data, anything could turn the tables in almost any way. And so China is very aware of that. They're trying to protect themselves, but we are facing common issues, and they're having to join that game. Also, we have a global language. Now, even English, for instance, where most of the world actually, there's more English speakers in China today than there are in America. Okay? Now, I'm not talking about the quality of their English, but they're English speakers because they have to study English in school. And when you've got 1.3 billion people and we have about 300 million, obviously there's going to be far more of them than there are of us. So English has connected the world in some pretty amazing ways. If you're going to do business anywhere in the world today, you do it in English. If you're going to get a higher degree anywhere in the world today, you get it in English. If you're going to travel today anywhere in the world, you basically travel in English. Pilots around the world take off and land in English. That is the global language. And I personally believe that God is going to hold us as native English speakers far more accountable than others because the whole world wants English. It's the only way to get ahead is to learn English. Now, that is the actual tongue language that I'm talking about, but there's far more to this language thing than what we're talking about. Actually, one of the ways that China is trying to get a hand up on the English speakers is there is a big move on right now for China to become the internet, for Chinese to become the internet language. And so what people are doing is the Chinese people are publishing more and more documents on the internet only in Chinese from research and things like that so that people are going to need it. And some are predicting, and I'm not necessarily because I just don't know enough, but some are predicting that it could be within, what would it be, 25, 50 years, that we may be a Chinese-speaking planet. So I'm not sure. But just be aware of that. There is a move. Because to control the language is to control a lot. So the other thing is that we, around the world, see, it used to be when the world wasn't a global world, when it was, we had our nice little niches, Buddhists were trying to solve their regional problems in their part of the world from a Buddhist worldview. Muslims were trying to solve their part, their problems in their region from an Islamic worldview. And we could go on and on. And name all the worldviews. But what's very fascinating is today, because the world is globalized, we're sitting at a global conference table trying to solve the world's problems from all the worldviews being in on the conversation. And that's where it gets difficult. And see, worldviews are not just a difference of opinion. I almost, and you will understand this after taking perspectives, but I almost chuckle when I read the newspapers and some of the reporters' questions about why is it we can't just go and do this? Why is it that, and I just can't believe that our government, who's supposed to have consultants, are thinking that if we just do this, this will be the impact because it's a total disregard for worldviews. Worldviews are deeply held frameworks of thinking in which they process information. And so we are sitting at a global conference table with all of the worldviews present trying to solve the globe's problems, and I can tell you that that's where the worldview clashes are happening. And that's why the kinds of conversations about the war and such radically different ideas is on the table, because we don't understand it's a worldview conversation. And see, all the other worldviews, they are all the lofty things raised up against the knowledge of God. That's really what they are. And so unless we understand how to have worldview conversations, it's no longer four spiritual laws or do you know where you're going to go if you die when you go to heaven. That's not the conversation going on. The conversation is about how to best live life on this planet. It's a war of ideas. It's a war of how to live life. It's a war about what is important in life and what you sacrifice for and that sort of thing. So the global language is not only English, but it's really a worldview language. And I can just tell you, you're never going to be real effective unless you learn how to have worldview conversations. China's harvestable season. I'm going to deal a lot more tomorrow morning with season, so I'm going to kind of take this a little slow. But I would just mention two things right now. China is in a harvestable season. It wasn't 20 years ago. It wasn't even 15 years ago, and in the last 2 to 3 years, literally around the world, Chinese people are open to the gospel. It is God's point in history for the Chinese, at least this season. And what we find out is harvest seasons don't last long. It's just like in the fields, if any of you have been near farms. When it's harvest season, all hands are on deck. And we work morning, noon, and night because the harvest season is going to last long. And what is not harvested is wasted. And what we have is example after example after example where God has responded to our prayers in different parts of the world. He's opened a people. They've been very harvestable, and we couldn't get there quick enough. And I will explain more about that tomorrow. But please just understand, China is harvestable today. It's come because there's been focused prayer for 30 years on China. It's because their political system has disappointed them after Tiananmen Square. It has just been a series of disappointments because everything they live life for has dissipated. Last October, I was sitting in a room in China. We had six meetings in 2 days with different kinds of groups of people, a group of mothers, single moms, a group of elderly who had gone through the whole revolution and had given their life for China, and anyway, and a whole series of meetings. But I can tell you that these elderly people, I was so touched because they never talk about it. They were all friends, and they had never talked about it with each other. But as we began to ask some questions, just one by one, they began to open up. And they expressed that they were terrifically hungry, they were terrifically cold, but it was for the factory. They lived for the factory. They believed in Mao. They believed he was a god. They worshipped him. They talked about their devotion to him just like we would talk to about our devotion to Jesus, but it was even more, they were more devoted than most of us would even express. They lived life for that. After Tiananmen Square and things began to change, they had worked all their life for that, and the Chinese government sold the factory to some rich guy anyway, and basically it was either torn down or converted to something else, and their whole lifelong thing that they had worked for retirement was cut off, and here they are in old age without anything they worked for and with everything shattered, all their dreams shattered. And I can tell you, their political system has disappointed them. I could tell you story after story, even about some Chinese in our country who were very much disappointed and have now either come to faith or there is certainly an emptiness. Also, the global forces have shaped change that they don't have answers for. There's been the intensity of the challenges, everything from the urbanization to the economic development and things, and there has been the pace of change has been so rapid. My first time in Beijing was in 1985. And I went and literally every building was gray. There was no color. Every building was gray and there wasn't a single sign on a building. So the locals knew, they weren't used to outsiders coming and no one had to sign anything because everybody knew what was in that building. But literally you couldn't tell if it was groceries or a bomb-making factory or what it was. And everyone wore the same color clothes. You were either green clothes or navy. Now, in 85, there were a few children occasionally that had another color on. But everything was green and blue in terms of clothing, and all buildings were gray, no signs. I went back in 95. I'd been to some other cities since then, but in 95 I went back to Beijing, and it was like Las Vegas. It was all like neon lights, flashing neon lights. There were signs everywhere. People were in Western-type clothes, and I mean, it's amazing. But all of that happened in 10 years. So the pace of change is incredible, and it's just eating their lunch. So it's left these vacuums and this emptiness and this lack of control and all the things that create a hunger in your heart to find something stable. So in addition to the forces of change that I've been describing, there is the growing challenge for her successful Olympic bid, and they got world trade status 3 years ago. And now China has set in motion a new urban policies, as I mentioned, to move millions back to the already burgeoning cities for economic development. So there was already all this chaos going on, and then they got the Olympic bid, so they've got lots of work to do. They became eligible for the world trade status and did get that, and they've been trying to get that for 22 years. And people say that the economic development in those 22 years reaching world trade status was incredible, that no other country has ever had that kind of development that fast. Now, all of this, though, creates needs and other things that we believe are a pathway for the gospel. City infrastructures are pressure-filled. They're inadequate to keep up with the press of new people and leaving them open to new input. The cities are begging for professionals to come and to help. Housing, water, waste management, education, healthcare, you just name it, just right down the line. Actually, there's some fascinating figures here in just a few moments that I'll share with you. China's massive social and economic transformation has brought both unprecedented challenge as well as new opportunity for Christians to contribute to the literal rebuilding of the nation and its worldview. That's the kind of day that you and I live in. That's what God is doing. That's what He's brought China to. As I mentioned, 180 cities are over 1 million people. 100+ of these cities have no measurable Christians. Now, you've heard about the incredible movement of the church in China, and it has been there, but it's primarily taken root in the rural areas. But there's 100 with no measurable Christians, and that means that it's under a half of 1%. If it's under a half of 1%, they don't measure it. There are 5 to 15 new cities reaching the 1 million mark every year. That many cross the million mark. There's an uneven distribution of cities. What we're finding is the huge number of cities are in the southeast of China. Again, rivers plentiful, but they're already having all kinds of difficulty because of that. And so pure water and all these kind of things, there's just so much pressure being put on these cities. But the Chinese government is proposing to build 1,500 new cities in the next 25 years because they want to even out the distribution, so they want to create more of them in the real areas where there are not many people and it's cold and it's rugged and it's all those kinds of things in the northwest of China. So that's kind of their answer to it, is to force people. And then they have the largest city in the world now. And 87 of the cities over 1 million people are between 1 and 2 million people. But what I want you to understand about these 87 cities, actually it's more like 89 or 90 right now, but these are the cities that the rural people, when they're forced back to the cities, are going to because they are the most rural of the cities. They sound huge to us, but they have very much a rural feel. They're more agricultural based, more rural, animal husbandry and that sort of thing. And so they are not the biggest. They're the smallest of the cities. Yes, it's 33 million is what I've heard. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that was about a year ago, that figure. So I'm not sure exactly what it is now. Mm-hmm. But these 87 cities with 1 to 2 million, they're expecting them to double in about the next 3 years. They were they were supposed to double in about 4, and right now they're saying we have about another 2 to 3 years before they would have doubled what they were 2 years ago. Okay? Now, I don't know if you've thought about the kind of infrastructure that would happen in your city if it doubled its need for housing, education, health care, water, sanitation, all those kinds of things. So what's happened, I mean, you can figure it out. So what we feel, and these 87 cities are among the 100 that have no measurable Christians. It's almost all Han Chinese cities. And what's very interesting is the Christians from the rural areas have been among the kind of profile that they're trying to move back to the cities. And so I thought, oh, great. When I first heard this 4 years ago, I said to my friend, I said, I am so excited because that means God has been preparing them. Now he's going to move in the cities to evangelize the cities. He said, you don't understand. And this is what he has told me, and this is what I've read since. But the Christians that move to the cities are losing their faith. See, they've received their faith, and they've lived in their faith in a small rural area in a context of family and of friends that are also sacrificing and suffering for being believers. They move to the cities alone, and they can't relate. They don't feel like they belong, many times with great difficulty, many times homeless. And they're not connecting to the church of the cities, which a lot of them don't have many. And so they are losing their faith. There's just too much pressure and too much instability in their life, and there's no community. Now, what's very fascinating, I want to just jump for a moment to tell you about a man that I met about 4 or 5 years ago. In understanding this, one of the things that he did was he was a businessman, and his church and two other churches have a partnership now for a city in China. And one of the things that he's doing, they have set up some businesses there, and in hiring their workers, they are actually hiring a whole house church from a rural area that needs to move the cities, and they're bringing him in as a house church to try to sustain faith and that sort of thing. So he's trying to help bring some answers to it. I think it's a fascinating kind of strategy. So then they know that this house church will evangelize those others that are in the factory. So that's one of their plans. We just don't have enough of those plans. But these 87 cities, I want to submit to you, I believe, are a focus for our generation. Because they're doubling so fast, we know they're unusually harvestable. We know that their government and they're desperate for help with the infrastructure. And we know that we have the capacity, we would be invited in, we would be allowed to help shape the destiny of those cities. And so we feel like they're the most harvestable and the most doable in terms of what Americans have to provide. Now, I don't know if you are in the points in your studies in school where you're choosing careers or you're choosing the shape of the specialty of your career field, but I would suggest to you that you look around and see the kind of things God's doing and say, how could I be a part of that? And within the context of who he's made me, are there some things I'm interested in that I could shape my career a little bit more this way? You know, are any of you interested in city planning? Are you interested in waste management? You know, you never thought of waste management. You know, science in general, but, you know, I've never thought of that. But, wow, you know, that's the way God could use me. So, and around the world, waste management is going to be one of the big issues. The wars of tomorrow are going to be fought over water. Clean water is a desperate need. It relates to all the health care issues around the world. I just challenge you to really be thinking critically about your profession and how it could connect to the things that God is doing. We just have a little bit more here, and then I'd like for us to take a quick break, okay? What does China need? In other words, what would really make a difference if it's harvestable now? I believe that there are some emerging roles in world evangelism in general, so I'm going to do these general things, but I want you to think about it in relationship to China. Because we are in a different era of mission history that has just shifted in very recent years, it's still shifting, there's some new roles that are needed. And so one of the things that we need far more of than ever before, whether you ever leave our shores or you don't, it doesn't matter. We need advocates. We need those who will champion the cause of these places where God has opened it. Okay? And so we need advocates that will be ravenous. How you live, you sleep, you breathe, you sleep, you eat, that people, that they must be reached. You're like a John Knoxer. And we need advocates. And it can be a church that's the advocate. It could be a student group. It could be a person. It could be a family. But we need advocates. And what they're responsible for is vision, to spread the vision, the passion, the focus, the strategy for this people or this city. We need those who will be catalysts. And the catalysts are the ones that actually get something done about it. They began to find channels for the faith that's awakened among the Christian community for this people. They develop projects, and they are actually responsible for actually engaging that unreached city or that unreached people. So they're the ones who say, there isn't anything today. By God's help, I want him to use me to see this place engaged and moving. And we need activators. And the activators are the ones that are responsible to get the resources from all over the world, from all of God's people, and focused on this. In fact, activators could be called mobilizers, okay? But they're responsible. I believe that we really need to identify those that have apostolic gifts, and that's the church planting missionary gift, and you're going to hear more about that tomorrow. But we must identify them, because most Christians that actually have that gift, they're not using the gift for kingdom purposes. They're using it to start businesses and other things, because it's what we call the entrepreneurial gift. And so we need those apostolic teams, that apostolic person that will create the apostolic field teams. And they're responsible for relating to the unreached, for church planting, for training, for reproducing the church around the world. And we've got to identify them and call them out for that purpose. And I believe we need the cultural creatives. They're responsible for shaping the message, especially to those of us back home, so we can understand what God's doing, the ongoing communication about the people of the city, and to help us with worldview. And whether, you know, you're graphics art or you're a filmmaker or whatever, I believe we need the cultural creatives involved in global evangelization in a way that can help move things. And I believe we need the futurists. Now, typically you don't see applications for futurists, but they are the ones that can kind of see what God's doing, and they began to see the trends before anyone else is seeing them. They began to have concrete information, and they usually are very wide in their scope, because they can begin to see what's emerging. And they're the ones that get the church ready for what God's doing. And if you'll bear with me, and you'll hear me say a few things tomorrow that I'm saying tonight. And I understand you make up a big majority of the class, is that right? But let me give you one example. 2 years ago, 2003, in March, we could tell the war was getting ready to happen. And we know, just based on the fact that war is devastating, that the Iraqi people would be open, that they would be harvestable right after that. So I began to work to pull some key agencies and others together for a strategic focus. Actually, I'd been invited in by some of them, and then we began to pull others in so that we could really make sure that what we did wasn't duplicating, and that it had a strategic focus, and that we were there on time. Now, I began to call some of the major prayer movements, and I said, how fast can you get there? You know, we need you to break up the fallow ground. We need you in there first. Not one of the major prayer movements that I spoke to, which was about 20 of them, could move. This was March of 2003. Nobody could get there before the end of 2004, early 2005. And the reason given, as I inquired in every case, was our budget's already committed, our calendar's already committed. So then I thought, okay, I'm going to go to some churches that have said they're interested in the Muslim world, and we'll get them on board. You know, so I asked, could you send some intercessors? Every one of them, and these were the ones already saying they wanted to be involved in the Muslim world among the unreached. Not one could get there before late 2004, early 2005, the same kind of time frame, about 18 months. And in every case, it was the same thing. Our budget's already committed, our calendar's already committed. So what I realized in more clarity than I ever had is that when God is opening something, when God does something, especially when he does it suddenly, or when he does it silently, we don't quite see it coming. We are not ready. So we pray, but we somehow don't expect him to answer because we're not getting ready for the answer. And all of church history is filled with this. In Japan, we weren't ready. And so they bought our materialism because the business people were ready. But the Christians weren't. And so by and large, we have not been ready for God's answers. And when harvest time is there, we're not there. We usually arrive way too late, usually 2 years too late. And the harvest, most of the good harvest is already gone. And so then we simply have to wait for another season. With Japan, we've been waiting almost 50 years now. And some feel that there could be a season of harvest coming, 10 years, 5 years, we don't know. But when the harvest season is over, it's over. Because we have a seasonal God, and he opens things in seasons. All the world isn't ready tonight, but there are certain parts of the world that are ready. And so what we must understand is that the futurist can help us spot what's coming. After that experience with Iraq, I began to challenge the pastors I was working with. I said, would you set aside some of your calendar and some of your budget and just mark it for God? You know, just say this is for whatever God chooses to do. Well, I want to tell you, two of the churches actually took me up on that. And when the tsunami hit on December 26th, one of the churches was on the plane by January 2nd, and the other church was on the plane by January 4th. Because they had some budget set aside, and they had some space in their spirit to say, when God moves, let's move. I believe they get the church ready, the futurists do. They can interpret what God's doing, and they can help with the strategy part. And so I believe we need people that really have natural bents and gifts this way. You can't just say, okay, I'm going to be a futurist. That sounds cool. You know, if you're just not naturally a futurist, you're probably not going to be real helpful here because there are just people that tend to have an ability to do that. And then I believe that the main thing we need is we need to engage our Christian professionals. And so what we're going to do is we're going to talk in just a few minutes about the role of the other 98% of the church, because every city in China and every city in every other nation, we have the same exact domains or spheres or infrastructure. Every city, every nation has education, healthcare, economics, family life, a spiritual domain, technology, science, arts, that sort of thing. Every nation, every city has the exact same ones. And in a global world, it's globally connected. Scientists connect to scientists, and these very spheres are the things that God talks about. He has something to say about business. He has something to say about government. He has something to say about education. In other words, he has guidelines. And so as believers, if we understand how he says we're to work as an economist, then we can literally develop the infrastructure. We can help with the infrastructure to be much more doing things God's way if we can move. So not only do we have personal evangelism along the way through friendships and connections, but we actually can reshape the whole nation. So, and I'll tell you some more stories tomorrow about that. But I want us to understand that. So when we come back, and how long a break should we take? Okay, about 10 minutes, and then we'll come back, and I want to try to talk to you about some ways to practically move in. Okay? Thanks. We finished with these domains, these sectors of society, these parts of the infrastructure of a city or nation. And there are more than these, but there are not many more than these. But it's, again, what makes a city work, it's what makes a nation work. Again, 99% of believers are where every week, all week? They're out in the domains. Is that not true? They have domain expertise. And so what happens is when they're brought in to global evangelization, see, what's happened to us is we've had such a division between the secular and sacred parts of our life, right? Hurry up and finish your job so you can come to the church and do ministry, right? And it's a total misunderstanding. It's a artificial division because the scripture never has it. And we have such a division between clergy and laity. And yet the scripture never has that. And so we have totally misunderstood. And again, you're going to understand some more things tomorrow morning. But what I want to show you is once these kinds of people that have these kinds of expertise are brought in to global evangelization, let's say in a city in China, they bring skill set that the China cities need. They bring knowledge that the China cities don't have. They bring experience that the Chinese people do not have, the missionaries don't have, the national believers don't have. They have mobility. They can go in and out. They can even go to other parts of the world, connect them to other parts of the world. They have resources. They have connections to resources that they don't have. They have influence to get things done in other parts of the world as there, as well as there. Let me just give you an illustration. A year ago, last October, in New York City, a friend of mine said, "Hey, I've got a friend I want you to meet before he has to take the train back for work tomorrow." He said, "He's just gotten interested in missions." I said, "Really?" So as we met, I met John, and I said, "Hey, John, what do you do?" And he said, or "Where do you work?" I think is what I asked. He said, "At Yale." I said, "What do you do?" He said, "I'm a professor." I said, "What is your, you know, area?" He said, "Finance." I said, "What's your specialty?" He said, "Stock market." So I said, "Well, okay. you know, what is your interest in missions? What's happened?" He said, "Well, I just went with my church on the first my first short-term trip." And I said, "Great. What did you do? Where'd you go?" He said, "I went to Guatemala and I built houses." And my question was, "Why?" He said, "What do you mean, why? That's what you do when you get interested in missions, isn't it?" And I said, "You know that you could have gotten an audience with the leaders of the government there just because you have Yale behind your name? And because of your expertise?" He said, "Really?" I said, "See, you could have affected the whole nation in those same 10 days. Now, I realize you're not, you know, you're not above building houses, but other people can do that who really have the skills to do that. But you could have shaped things at another whole level." And so he said, "Okay, I'll give you a challenge." He says, "Tell me, you know, where should I go and what kind of opportunities would there be? Because I've never thought about that kind of thing." I said, "Well, Iraq right now," this was in October 2003, the war was over, you know, everything was chaos. I said, "Iraq right now has no infrastructure at all. They're building from the ground zero. I mean, they have nothing. Everything's starting over. You could go in right now because they would be open to you, not only because they need help, but because you're from Yale. And so you could say," he said, "Well, let me stop you." He says, "They don't have a stock market. It doesn't fit." And I said, "No. Do you think they want to be there someday?" And he said, "Well, sure they do." I said, "Then who better than you?" And I knew enough for my friend to realize he had a very biblical worldview. So I said, "Well, who better than you to go in? They will just see you as from Yale, but I see you as, you know, from the kingdom. And you can go in. You can say, now, if you want to get there someday, be sure and ask these questions now. Be sure and don't do this right now. Be sure and build this in from the very beginning. And you can help them shape things just because you have Yale behind your name." So influence. These people have influence that you and I don't have, right? They have knowledge. They have connections to things. They have positions that impress people and will give you a hearing. They have positions that can get things done that no one else can do. I can tell you example after example where people in positions in major corporations have gotten a whole corporation to go along with something and actually benefit something that brought all kinds of resources to it, expertise, all that sort of thing. So positions, they have new eyes. They don't have the same eyes as a missionary or national believer. So they have eyes to see things that those right there can't see. They have roles that they can many times actually activate a whole new group of resources. So they bring things, just ordinary believers out in corporate life or a business person or an educator, they just simply bring things to the global evangelism table that have never been brought in the last 50 years or so. And they can move things along kingdom-wise. So it's really back to the future. And I'm going to read you a passage from the Message Bible. And it says, after this, it was after God used them to heal a man. The people standing around couldn't take their eyes off of them. Peter and John, standing there so confident, so sure of themselves. Their fascination, as talking about the people standing around, their fascination deepened when they realized that those two were laymen with no training in scripture or formal education. They recognized them as companions of Jesus. But with the man that had been healed right there before them, seeing him standing there so upright, so healed, what could they say against that? Peter and John, ordinary believers. And I believe this is the day for the ordinary believers as well as the full career missionary. And so in your mobilization, you need to understand some of that too. We're going back to the future because this is not a new thing. The Christian faith has always spread along the trade routes, as they were the places where conversation happened. You can trace world history and the spread of the gospel around the trade routes. It was where the business people went. It was where the ship merchants went. And it's always spread that way until the last 200 years. This is not a new thing. It's as old as the carpenter's bench at Nazareth. Think about that. It was under Jewish law that every Jewish rabbi had to have a trade. No rabbi could take money for teaching or preaching. He had to earn his living by working at some trade, working with his hands as well as his brain and with his words. So we find rabbis were tailors, carpenters, leather workers, and barbers. Honest work is valuable to men and honored by God. Now, a lot of times we call these kinds of people bivocational or tent makers. But most of the time, bivocational in our mind means they can't make it in the real ministry, and so they have to somehow support their ministry through working. It's a total misread of what God has intended. We are all to be about the Father's business wherever we are. It's not secular and sacred division of our lives. In fact, God, if we understand the sovereign God who has created us, Colossians says that he has created us for him. He says we're created by him and for him. And then he has journeyed us through a certain set of experiences with a certain family and with certain events in our lives to shape us for what he has. And that passion he puts on you to pursue this career, all that's from him. And it's to prepare you for the day in which he's at work and the day he has you on watch in global evangelization. So part of it is just really understanding what he's doing in your day, so you understand why you're who you are, because he made you for him, himself, and what he's doing. I call kingdom professionals people who are Christians in the marketplace, but who live with kingdom intentionality. So the only difference to me between a Christian professional and a kingdom professional is intentionality. In other words, will you live your life watching for how God wants to use you in his big plan and his purposes? What difference would it make to students that you work with as you go back, or if you're on the traveling teams? And you know this, and perhaps you've been in this situation. I grew up thinking I've got to sit in this room and try to figure out what I'm supposed to do and what I was made to be. And I was always told to ask questions like, well, what would really fulfill you? You know, what would you just love getting up every day for? I want to just submit to you, I believe that's an entirely wrong way to approach it. Now, I believe that when you find it, you will want to get up every day, and I believe you will feel fulfilled. But that's starting with you. And it's not about you. It's about him and what he's doing. And if you were created by him and for him, and he's journeyed you, and you have these certain loves, and you love art, or you love this, and you really do like to be around people, you don't like to be around, you know what, all that is for him to tell you what to do and what not to do, you know? And so I really believe that one of the things is that we have to find out what he's doing and figure out with who he's made us to be, how that connects. And so as a Christian in the marketplace, you live with kingdom intentionality, you know, understanding this, then you become truly a kingdom professional. You're helping move the gospel and accomplish God's purposes on earth. Some effectiveness factors that we've discovered with these professionals is they answer the expertise factor. So many of the missionaries today are in closed countries, and they're pretending to be a businessman, or they're pretending to be an educator, and they're really not a very good one. And so they don't bring the kind of quality expertise that's really needed. And you know what? The world can smell that. These other countries, they can smell it. They know if you're pretending. Or do you really bring value to their nation? I believe that we should be the greatest value adders that there are in the world. And they bring the domain factory. It locates us in the domains of their society that can help build their society, can help build the nation, can help bless the nation. which God calls us to do. And it also answers the credibility factor, so that there's no pretending, and that you're actually credible with the leaders of that nation. So then you bring credibility to who Jesus Christ is, because you represent him. And it brings the connection factor. You're connected to things that no missionary is connected to and no national believer is connected to. You can get to places they can't get to because of your connections to resources, to expertise, to thinking, to all sorts of things. So you just bring. And so that's why there's so much effectiveness with Christian professionals who will be kingdom intentional about their profession. Let me just stop there, because I believe that's what China needs. China is not allowing missionaries in. In fact, if they find that you're, quote, missionary, you will be not only not invited, but you will be kicked out if you get there. And so China, if we are really going to make impact in China, we will really need to go as professionals, credible professionals who can add value, especially if we're going to reach the cities. Now, someone asked me about the churches in China. China has a huge church. It's primarily in the rural areas. They're not very effective in the cities. There are some in the cities, but they're not real effective usually there. And what we find is that then there's the Three Self Church, and I think you guys have dealt with that some, right? So you know what I'm talking about. That's the official church, and it's sometimes there's the gospel given, sometimes it's just nice talk. But what we find is there's a third kind of church emerging in China, because they have been so receptive the last 3 to 5 years. The most receptive group of people on your campus will be the mainland Chinese international students. They are just coming to faith right and left. They just need a messenger. And so, but there's a third kind of church emerging in China, and that is the professionals. Those that are in the domains, those that are the professionals in China, they are coming to faith, but they're not comfortable in the rural feel of the underground church, and they're not comfortable in the government church. So they are creating their own churches, and they typically look a lot like a house church, but they would be for professionals. So it's this emerging professionals church that's there. It's a third wave church in China. And it's growing. It's probably the most rapidly growing from what I understand. And I can't verify that, but that's what I'm hearing from some of my colleagues. So let me just pause for just a minute. And I'd like to ask you to just kind of turn to a couple of other people. And I just want to see what this stirs in you. In other words, is there a question that comes out of what we've talked about? Or is there anything perhaps I could answer? I don't have all the answers for China, believe me. But is there anything that perhaps I've been unclear about or something like that? Okay, let's pull back together if we can. Okay, any questions or statements? Are there sending agencies that are sending professionals? Many sending agencies will send professionals, but usually what they do is incorporate them into a mission paradigm type of ministry rather than totally domain oriented, you know. So in other words, they go in the professional thing in order to be there, in order to fund and stuff like that. But typically they want them to hurry up and finish the job so they can do real ministry, what they call real ministry. That's the way most agencies are approaching it. Mm-hmm. A number of them, yeah, they have that value and things like that, but again, they're, I would say there's few good examples, yeah, of that, yeah. There are some great examples, but they're not usually coming out of agencies. Again, see, the governments and government of China even will pay your salary for many things. For instance, let me give you an example. When they got the world trade status a few years ago, one of the things, because their accounting standards weren't up to the world's accounting standards, so one of the things that was in the agreement for the world trade status is they had to bring that up. Well, they only had a quarter of the accountants they need. So they were actually, on the front page of the Wall Street Journal was a big article. They were looking for Americans to come and train accountants. Now, that could be for a couple of months. It could be for a couple of years. So do we have accountants sitting in our pews, you know, every Sunday that just, you know, wish God could use them in some way? I mean, an incredible opportunity. So, yeah, and they would pay for it. Now, you don't get the kind of salary you get here, but, again, if you're on mission with God, it's okay. The Western influence in China, yes, there is a good bit, but a lot of it is coming as they send their scholars out too, and it is changing things, and it's changing values. In other words, they own cars now and all those kinds of things. A lot of them do. The majority don't, but many own cars and things now. So it's having quite an impact on the way they live, the kind of expectations they have. It's having radical influence, and many feel like it will be perhaps the toppling of the government for the first time in 4,000 years from the standpoint of people power and things like that. Again, you can read one article and it will kind of take you in this direction. Another article says, no, it's going to end up. You see, many are saying that about a year before the Olympics, when it's too late for the world to do anything about it, that the government's going to clamp down harder than ever in order to get control again. Others say it's probably going to go on the way it's going and that the government will have less and less influence. I don't know which direction it's going to go, because the Chinese people that understand the Chinese government, people much wiser than me in terms of that, they just say they've not changed their stripes even though they look like they have. So expect some pretty good bloodshed in a few years. Again, I don't know. Yeah. But it is impacting. Yeah. Okay.
So you think that like this is going to be just a window of
harder. Right.
Do you have any idea like?
Well, again, when they get all the commercial things and they're being satisfied in other ways, they're not going to be as open. So, and they are accumulating things very, very fast. Yeah. And most feel like by the time we get to the Olympics, our main window is over. Yes, I would. I think there's really three world priorities right now. One is the Muslim world is opening up pretty fast. It's not fully harvestable yet, but it's opening. India is incredibly opening fast. Again, will it be 5 years? Will it be 2 years? Will it be 10 years? I don't know. But India and the Muslim world are neither one fully harvestable yet, but there is an incredible harvest going on. But it's ripening. But China is already there. And so we've got to keep our eye on those three bulbs. They're the most opening groups right now.
How do you suggest that we do that and know these things when we don't have somebody like that knows?
One of the things is keep your eye on the things that make people open. In other words, when there's vacuums, when there's dissatisfaction, and I'll talk a little bit more about this tomorrow. But when there's emptiness that, and their old answers don't meet the new questions, there is openness in an individual, in a city, and a nation. Think about when your friends become open to Christ. They weren't yesterday, they are today. It's because their mother died yesterday, very unexpectedly, or their child was had an amputation, or any number of things. I mean, it usually comes with trouble. It also can come with incredible blessing. And so what you watch for is these kinds of things. What was very fascinating to me is one of the mission groups that specializes in the Islamic world, they were the ones that kept telling us with Iraq, they won't be open for another 20 years. See, they were too close to it, and they weren't looking at receptivity factors. They just knew how hard it had been the last 20 years. And so, but if you understand the way God works, He usually works suddenly or He works silently. But when harvest is there, it's fully there, and you better move. Yeah, because it doesn't last long. And let me tell you, for instance, on your university campuses, there are well-seasoned professionals from China today that are lawyers, that are school principals, that are all these things. And China is sending them So they're not like a student like you and I, you know, I mean, where we're just starting in university or something. I mean, they're seasoned professionals that are coming to, in a sense, get more skill, a Western skill. And 95% will go back never having been an American home, and really it's probably more like 98%. And yet they're open. How many lawyers are sitting in your church, or how many educators are sitting in your church that could build a friendship with a student while they're here? And it leads them to faith. For instance, we had 50, Beijing sent 50 of their top principals to LA for a year, no, excuse me, for 10 months to get a degree at Hope International University. And it was so that they could learn. See, another thing that's happened with China is, in terms of economic development, 4 years ago, they decided to start educating all their people. Well, they've never educated all their people. They've only educated those who could pass certain tests, and they're elite, really. But they decided to educate all their people. It was the only way they could actually compete in the world global economy. See, so the globalization is what's pushing all these buttons for them. And so, but now they don't know, they don't have the infrastructure to train all their people, but they have a goal to do that. And they've always done their education by rote memory. And so now they have to actually learn how to educate the masses. They didn't know how, so they started with sending, Beijing sent 50 of their principals. Well, I heard about it through a friend, and so we offered to do homestays, weekend homestays for any of them that were interested. Almost all of them took us up on it, and out of the 26, I think it was here, and I think 24 of them did homestays, 17 came to faith before they went back. Because we put them in the home with some educators, and as much as we could, principals and superintendents at school and stuff like that. And so my colleague worked on all the matching, you know, and I used all my connections to talk to churches about who would, you know, be willing to take them, and then we negotiated the travel and everything. And so there's just all sorts of opportunity to impact China from here even, and yet we haven't had a focus on it. Well, I don't know if you can hear the question, but it was, what is my thought about the Three Self Church and the House Church? Probably every story you've heard is true somewhere. So, for instance, in 85, I was meeting with a Three Self Church leader who had been brought out to Hong Kong, and we were discussing things. And really, in talking to him, I realized, you know what, he isn't even a believer. And so they have many Three Self Church leaders that are not even believers, but they go in and do like lectures and things that are religious, but they're not what we call. And yet there are other Three Self Church pastors that are incredibly Christian, you know, and they're passionate about God, but they're in that system. But again, they're controlled and what they can and can't say and things like that. And again, until recently, if you were a believer, you couldn't even tell your children that there was a God or that there was a Jesus. So you couldn't even discuss in your own home or you'd be turned in. And children were taught to turn in their parents and things like that. Again, it's as varied as it is. But in general, the Three Self Church is controlled by the government or the Bureau of Religion. And again, the head of that usually isn't a believer either. So. And then the underground church, again, there's bad ones, and there's ones who have been co-opted by people that would lead people astray. So in other words, by cult type things. But by and large, it's very strong, and it's very it's moving rampantly, and they really do release the apostolic church planting kind to go, and they sacrifice greatly for that. So you have everything in between. I don't know if you've read The Heavenly Man. It's a book you can't put down if you start reading it. But again, you know, you hear different stories there too, but by and large, friends of mine that know the situation feel that it's very accurate. And so, for instance, in this whole thing of the Back to Jerusalem movement, have you heard of that? Okay, well, the Back to Jerusalem movement, there's some that say that there's people coming to the West to try to raise money for that, and they're co-opting the money and using it for other things. Again, I don't know so in that, but I do know that it's a serious movement, but that it's full of chaos also right now. We need to pray for those brothers. because there's a lot of disagreement within the Chinese church. So it's a struggle, and the biggest issue is training. They've been isolated so long that they have not had good theological training and some things like that. So there's a lot of error in things, but God is still doing some amazing things. The old country wisdom is God gets a lot of good things done out of crooked sticks, you know. So you just, you know, we need to pray for those brothers and sisters. They're doing what they know to do. Mm-hmm. Speech communications?
Yeah. I mean,
oh, absolutely, yeah. And the reason is because if you have a master's, you would get a teaching position in one of their communication schools. And I mean, that would be something very direct, and you'd have lots of good relational connection then and things like that. It could be that, you know, if you've got some experience in TV or radio or any other kinds of things, then again, you could go and help. So there's all sorts of things. Let me give you my read on this. We are in a day when missionaries are not invited. They're not welcome in most of the unreached areas. Now, if you want to go to some other reached areas, personally, I don't feel like that's good use and stewardship of your life, but if you want to do that, that's fine. I personally, and so I'm going to give you my read, okay? My read is that in Latin America, our job now is a mobilization job with the Latin church. And the reason is because I believe that all the movement in Latin America the last 50 years has been to have them equipped for this day when the Muslim world is opening up. There are 26,000 words in Arabic and Spanish that have the exact same root. There are 6,000 words that are exactly the same. The skin tone, the cultural forms, everything, it is such a match. And you send a Hispanic over, and they can do in 3 weeks what we haven't been able to do as Anglos in 3 years. So, right. So I believe our job now is a mobilization role in Latin America. So anyway, I am a little bit on a soapbox, so I want to warn you right now. With where we are in world evangelism today, what we need is credible Christians who have something to offer to the world. Let me ask you, why is it that the church is always reacting and marching and complaining against the world's talking agendas? Why is it we're always reacting to someone who is setting the agendas for cloning and genetic engineering and in ways that are bad? I'm not saying... in law, where secularism has taken over and that sort of thing. Why is it that we are not shaping the talking agendas in this global conversation? Why is it that Christians aren't doing it? Why is it that we're not earning the right by hard work and getting the advanced degrees to be able to set the world's talking agendas rather than just react to them? And I believe Christians have basically been lazy. And we've been so in our own world, talking to ourselves, that we don't. And so we say, "Oh, that's a pagan era." So we've gotten out of journalism. Journalism. The journalists are shaping the way that Americans think. The filmmakers are shaping the way that we think. It's shaping our worldview. Because we have abandoned those areas. We've said they're secular areas, and we don't belong there. And so, basically, we've isolated. And so I'm saying that for students today who are believers and who really want to impact the world for Christ, you need to pay the price, go to the future edges of your career fields, and earn the right to be heard around the world. There's a man coming to our conference this year that we're trying to get. We don't have a final yet. But, I mean, he is in charge of all the gene stuff, you know, and a scientist incredibly committed to Christ. Another brother has two postdocs in polymer binding chemistry that's been working in China for the Institute of Science and Technology and who is reaching the influentials because he's earned the right. And so I don't care what your career field is, look and see what's shaping up in your career field and go for the edges instead of just try to get out of school so you can go to the mission field. Okay? Earn the right to be heard. And so that when you're not only invited in, but when everyone else is asked to leave, you're asked to stay because you're so vital. You're so integral to that nation. So that's my soapbox. I'm through. I'm down. Okay? So, and that is a bias that I have based on what's happening, you know. So I want to admit that.
How do you fit this with
Yes, and that's why when we go to serve. See, we go to serve their needs. We go to serve them, to train them, to teach them, and to learn from them and to listen to them. And so we go in a humility. We don't go to lord it over, but we go to bless and to build. Yeah. We don't go as arrogant people like others that are not believers go in the same ways. Okay? I take one more and then we're going to move on. Okay, is learning the language essential? It is if you're going to stay long term, because you don't know culture till you learn language. They go hand in hand, because only in language do you actually understand culture. But today in a global world with pretty much the leaders and the movers and shakers, and I mean, they speak English if anyone has an advanced degree. So around the world, even 15 years ago, it was harder to get around the world without language. It's not hard at all today. You can go almost anywhere and find somebody that can learn language and, I mean, understand you and communicate. And not only that, they want to practice. So they're real excited that you do that. And a lot of professionals will not go and stay. They will be going in and out and influencing, just like this brother that I was telling you about from Yale. I said, you know, if you're in there at this time when they're hurting and they're building, you'll be their consultant for the rest of your life. I didn't tell you the end of the story. He said, you really think that could happen? I said, yeah. He said, well, I have a break in semesters in 3 weeks. And so I picked up my cell phone, called my friend in Baghdad, got him on the phone. 3 weeks later, he was there, and everything I described happened, you know. So it's unbelievable the kind of ticket we have to the world right now. Let's go on, because I want to just move towards some things that I feel like will help. How many of you are planning to go on traveling teams? A few of you. How many of you feel like... Okay. How many of you feel like that you'll do some mobilization? Just okay. All right, this is for you. It's for all of you. Okay? Because now you can color kingdom destinies of individuals and nations as well. I want to talk to you a little bit about what shifted in 21st century mobilization. Because we're in a different place, we're in a different world, we're focused on different kinds of countries than we used to be focused on, and the church is different, and Christians are different because we have a different culture. Vehicles are different. I mean, everything is different today. So it has shifted some mobilization. 2.5 years ago, I pulled together a consultation of our best mobilizers I could find in the U.S. to try to learn lessons and to see where we were. And so a lot of things I share with you will be things I shared with them on our first meeting, as well as some insights that came out of the consultation. And we're doing some of that this fall, too. Let me just mention a conference we're doing this October. We do it every year in a different city. This year it's in Seattle, October 21 and 22. And it's for professionals. And then there's a side-by-side conference for senior pastors and one for mission pastors and mobilizers. And so it's going to be kind of the same thing we're talking about. And so if you're interested in the professions, I don't know of anywhere that the kind of people that are going to be here are drawn together. And my cards haven't come yet, so you can just look at the website, intersectionconference.com, and you can see what's going to be there and the kind of people and the domains and stuff. But let's look here. The contrasting experiences. Let me just share with you what a typical believer experiences at church. How they experience something very different at work, and then what the kingdom calls us to. And to me, if you're a mobilizer, you're trying to move people from what they typically think about in church to the kingdom. Okay? Because at church, they typically come, and you and I do too, as consumers, don't we? We talk about whether we like the message or not, if the church has enough services for, you know, what we like. Do they have enough pretty girls or cool guys and enough meetings and parties and how good the Bible study is, things like that. We come as consumers. We become dependent on the church leadership to feed us. Feed me, feed me, feed me. Right? Isn't that true? Okay. And we see ourselves, if we do any ministry, as a volunteer. volunteers quit whenever they want to, right? So, but we see ourselves as a volunteer. We see ourselves as a laborer. So let's start going across. At church, we see ourselves as a consumer. At work, we see ourselves as a contributor. But in the kingdom, God calls us to be an investor. That's a very different position. Typically, I don't think when I go to church, I'm here to invest. You know, I don't think about that. Because my church has taught me to think very differently. And instead of being dependent, at work we're independent, and in the kingdom we're called to be interdependent. Instead of a volunteer at work, that's not how we see ourselves. We see ourselves as contracted to get a job done. And yet in the kingdom, God says we're a commissioned person. We're actually commissioned by a higher commissioner than our pastor or our youth director or our student director or our boss at work, but we're commissioned. And it's a whole different kind of way to be. Instead of just a laborer at work, we see ourselves as a free agent. We have to take responsibility for our own career. And all the research shows that people are changing careers as much as 5 to 7 times during a career today. Where my dad, you get in one and you stay all your life, you know. That has totally shifted. But the kingdom says we're a bondservant. We're a bondservant to Jesus Christ. And so that's there. Instead of at church just seeing ourselves as bringing some help to the pastors, at work we see ourselves as bringing value to this company. But in the kingdom, we're called to bring a calling. Again, God made us for him. We're made by him and for him. And the calling is an individual, very distinctive calling. No one else plays our part, just like no other church plays the part of my church in world evangelization. At church, we have a local picture. We see things locally. We're here to reach this community. But at work, most companies today are global in their orientation, even if they're not in their business practice. They actually have a global view of the world because they know that if they don't, they won't be in business in a couple of years. But the kingdom calls us to a global local picture, and you can't separate it out. It's a complete picture. It doesn't just have to do with over there. It has to do with here, too, but it doesn't just have to do with here, and it's not optional to divide them. It's a global local picture. At church, we see ourselves as bringing our gifts to bear. At work, we see ourselves as bringing our skills. But in the kingdom, we're called to bring purpose to the table, that we are to connect to God's purpose. And at church, it's about where I am, where I live. At work, it's about what I do. But in the kingdom, it's about who I am. So I see the mobilization role. Typically, we think of it as just putting someone in a mission slot. But I see it as actually moving people to a kingdom way to live and thinking. Okay? Mobilization. We have moved from the age of recruiting to the age of activating. Let me give you a story. I was in a perspectives class in the state of Michigan one night, and there was a man at the back. He was poorly kept, and he looked like he was going to sleep, and I figured this guy's going to leave at break, and sure enough, I expected him to. But instead, he made a beeline for me, and he began to express some things that I've been talking about, and he said, you know, what you're talking about is the sleeper agent. Well, this was before 911. I didn't have a clue what a sleeper agent was. And so I asked him to explain, and so he began to say that countries, they have sleeper agents that they send into other countries. It's a person that they have found, they have trained them, and then they move them into a enemy country. They tell them to go in and live like everybody else, to be a good citizen, to get a job, and just to be a good neighbor. And that when they need them, they'll call them. And when they need them, they activate them. And we found that on 911, we had sleeper agents in our country. And just prior to 911, they were activated. And that's why people said, oh, they were just a great neighbor. I would have never guessed. I mean, I can't believe it would do anything like that. Because we have sleeper agents. We still have sleeper agents in our country. And we have sleeper agents in other countries. But I began to reflect on this thing of the fact that we have... Our military is made up of people that are chosen, they're equipped and trained, and they are activated at a certain point when they're needed. In professional ball, you have people that are chosen, put on teams, they're trained, they practice, and some of them never play or rarely play, but when they're needed, they're activated. And I realized that I mentioned to you earlier, I have never really tried to mobilize. And yet, when I talk to people many times, they get mobilized. And so I had to start evaluating, why is it? And I really realized when I use the word recruiting, when I use the word mobilizing, it's kind of like it's something I'm doing to them. And what I realized with it activating, all I was doing, because I'm really interested in people, I want to tell you that as a 12-year-old, I felt called to the mission field, and I never made it. I told my pastor, I was so excited, and he patted me on the head, and he said, now when you graduate from college, come back and see me. Do you know how many decisions take place between the time you're 12 and you graduate from college? I was never one that was rebellious. I always wanted to make it. I just couldn't figure out how. In those days, they didn't have perspectives. They didn't have people that were mobilizers. They didn't have people that helped you figure out pathways. My parents are very brilliant, but they were not educated, and they didn't know how to help me get to college, and I never could figure it out. And my Sunday school teacher said, well, your parents are poor. You'll never be able to go. And so that's the kind of help I got. Well, because I never graduated from college, I never went back to see him, so I didn't make it in the field. And I figured that okay, I'm God's plan B for my life, and maybe plan C, you know, by the time I woke up to it. Well, God was very gracious to me, and in young adult life, after I already had three children, he really renewed that call in a very special way. And within a couple of weeks, some other sets of circumstances, and I had always been doing ministry, but never like in a real official capacity or on a staff or things. Well, anyway, within 2 weeks, I found myself on a staff at a church, and this was in the days before women were on staffs, and I've had an incredible privilege of serving the church for many years. But I'm convinced that I can do my calling whether I have a position or not. I don't believe I have to have a title or role or position, because our calling is individual. And our calling can be done if I'm cutting my kid's hair or if I'm sitting in an office or whatever. And so it was out of that failure, is what I felt for many years, that I realized God actually got me to where he really wanted me. And that was because I was so convinced that there's no one to help people, that once God touches a life to say, you know, I want to use you in some special way, there's no one to help you make it. And so everything I do, whether it's speaking or consulting or writing or anything, I feel like overall what I'm trying to do is help get ministry to being a good parent or whatever. Am I still scratching? Okay, I'm sorry. I'm not sure what I'm doing wrong. So what I find is that when you're talking to someone and you begin to see the things they like and the things that they've been involved in, you begin to see some of God's activity in their life. And the more you can understand what God's been doing and what he's put on their heart, I realized that all I do was acquaint this person with what God is doing to show them where it connected. And I realized that what I was doing was simply activating what God had already done in their heart. I was just activating it. And so what you're going to see here is some of the things that we see are trends and the ways that you effectively mobilize today. So don't think of yourself as a recruiter. You're much more of an activator. You're finding out what God has done so that he could connect them to what he's doing. And that activates them. And so you don't need to see yourself as filling a slot in some agency's job board. But you're filling the earth with the knowledge of the Lord. That's what you're trying to do. That's the objective, is we're trying to fill the earth with the knowledge of the Lord. We're not a salesman, but we're moving from being salesmen to matchmakers. What you're trying to do is match who they are with what God's doing. Okay? We're moving from being needs-oriented. Wow, this country is so needy, this people group is so needy. That's not as much what you want to do. Because what that did was that kind of approach mobilized my generation. Because if there was a need, then we should fill it. That's the way my generation thinks. Okay? It's not the way your generation thinks. And so the need compelled us, and so if we should, we would. Okay? Needs are not the thing that's going to move people. In other words, you do need to know about some of those things, but really that's not what it is. What you need to see is what assets God has brought to bear And so you're looking for the assets that this people brings. In other words, what did God do? So I'm really far more assets focused. Comes out of a story in my own youth ministry days. There was the way we did programs on Sunday morning, you know. And I remember their little booklet called This Sunday for a Solo. Now, none of my kids were musicians. None of my teenagers were musicians. But I talked this poor kid into singing a solo one Sunday, and he did it just because he wanted to please me. Well, as he began, everybody's eyes hit the floor. It was a disaster. And I was just groaning. I thought, what have I done to this poor kid? And that afternoon, I cried all afternoon. And I just said, God, there has got to be a better way. It's not about putting people in slots. It's not about the needs for this program. That's not what it's about. And that week, in a quiet time, I was reading a passage I'd read many times before, but it had never connected. It was in Ephesians 4, where it's talking about that the role of leaders is to equip the saints for their work of ministry. And I have to tell you that up until that time, I saw all the kids and all my youth workers as helping me do my ministry. My ministry was the youth ministry. And I want to tell you that's absolutely backwards. Because I was supposed to be there for them, to equip them for their work of ministry, which means I had to try to understand who they were and what God had shaped them for and made them for. I had to try to understand some things God was doing. Well, that changed me dramatically that day. And ever since then, I've been focused on the assets. I want to know what this person brings to the table. And from that day on in our youth ministry, I began to look around and see what kind of gifts and passions and things were there, and we shaped our programs around who we had. Now, I want to tell you, within a year, we had an incredible group of musicians. But I want to tell you, we didn't do any music until we had musicians. And so we began to really follow the Lord in this. If He's provided this group of people, then this is what He wants to use. And so we began to follow the Lord's leadership through what He had provided. Does that make any sense? And so instead of needs, we really focused on the assets that can come to bear. Because I can tell you the needs on the field can be met thousands of different ways. It can be met through educators, or it can be met through scientists, or it can be met a lot of ways. But the program you have will depend on who you have to do the program. So, and so in mobilization, we need to move from mobilizing individuals to mobilizing gatekeepers, if you're serious about mobilization as a mobilizer, okay, or as an activator. Instead of individuals, which typically we focus on, we need to really, I believe, focus on the gatekeepers, the youth ministers, the pastors, the student workers, the campus worker. Because they are the gatekeeper to all these others. If you mobilize them, if you can get them to a perspectives class to where they can get it, you know what? They will go on for years and years mobilizing. So you've just multiplied yourself. Does that make sense? You see? And so, or there's a cluster of kids and you can tell who the leader, then mobilize that leader because they'll mobilize the others. The other thing is we're in a day where we need to quit mobilizing disconnected people and trying to put them together on a team on the field. Team disasters are bringing more people home. Right now, the return rate home is over 50%. And almost every case is because the teams cannot get along on the field. And so we're finding incredible change in this when we go from mobilizing disconnected people and putting them together to mobilizing relational teams. And typically, if I can mobilize the team leader and let them get their team together, they will follow them because they would never go to the field to them if they didn't already trust them, you know, and some things like that. So it's teams you want to mobilize, not individuals, if that makes sense. Now, again, think about mobilizing a team. That's very different. And so you're going to have all kinds of different meetings. I mean, you're going to have a very different conversation with a team than you do with an individual. Unless you're just mobilizing a team leader. So it's a very different way to mobilize. And from marketing, let me go back to this just for a moment. In our congregation, one of the things we did was when we found people really passionate about going to the field, we said, that's great, super, phenomenal. But I want to challenge you to think about a lifelong time on the field, and I want to ask you, is there anyone or any group of people that you would love to live life with and grow old together with. You just love being around them. You want to live life and you want to grow old together. You know, the Billy Graham team is the only one who has never had a, kind of a blight on their name for embezzling or those kinds of things. They're a team that got together when they were young and they've grown old together. Very powerful way to minister. And so we would challenge people that really wanted to go to the field, then live life here, challenge your friends that you want to go. And I can tell you many more went to the field because they knew that if Dennis goes, he's going to bomb over there because he doesn't have a logistics bone in his body. If I don't go to be with him, you know, he's never going to make it. So you start getting all sorts of other things that come in play. And you know what? Everyone wants a community to live life and grow together with. That's the longing of our heart. So I really challenge you to help people, even in college, think about these kinds of things and how can they begin to plan together, minister together here, work out the difficulties here. And I can tell you, they're still going to have difficulties on the field, but nothing like the teams that just get put together in random ways. And then we're in a day where we move from marketing to niche engagement. What do I mean by that? It's not a general marketing. You can do that, and you're still going to mobilize a certain kind of person, but I don't believe you're going to mobilize the kind of people that really need to be on the field. As we've done surveys, as we've gone, typical missionaries on the field, about very few of them have the apostolic or missionary gift. And let me tell you why I think some of that is. We are in a volunteer system of missions. In other words, how do people go to the field? They volunteer. What kind of people volunteer? Those who have gifts of service and helps. Do apostolic people volunteer? No. Do logistics people volunteer? No. Administrative people don't volunteer for anything. All the gifts that you really need to get something done, they're not volunteers. See, the New Testament was an appointment system. They looked at people, and as far as I can tell, the New Testament, they chose them for their willingness to be martyred. They chose them for their faith and their faithfulness and their willingness to be martyred. And they were asked, they were commissioned, they were pulled out. And so I believe we're in a day that we don't just mass market and say who wants to volunteer. I believe we need to find out what God's doing and find out what kind of people are needed to address that, and we need to go after them. Right now, I mean, if we know about China, one thing we can go after is accountants. We could just simply let them know of the need and what God's doing, this incredible opportunity. So I mentioned the kingdom professionals. I believe we need to mobilize the kingdom professionals. They are people who begin to live with kingdom intentionality. Let me share with you some things that I've learned. First of all, let me go back to this. We have till another half hour? Okay, let me stop here and just these things I've said. Mobilization is moving from this to this. I want to ask you now to talk, get where you can see each other eyeball to eyeball, four people, three people, something like that. But I want you to say, ask yourself, what does this change about what I've been thinking? What kind of questions does this answer? Or what do I disagree with? I don't care how you want to phrase it. But anyway, just talk together for a few minutes. What is shifting for you as we talk about this? Let's gather again. What kind of what thought or idea has perhaps answered a question for you and you're excited about? I mean, you know, something that kind of charges your juices. Anybody? Has it answered any questions? Difficulty?
I really like what you said about the teams, mm-hmm. and especially thinking long-term missions, not only being connected to those people well, but staying connected after you have to move from one place to another after you already established the church.
Uh-huh.
I think it's good for fellowship with you.
Right. Okay. Good. We just have to be careful not to establish a mission compound over there. So, okay. All right. Okay. Okay. Yep. Yep. That's right. Right. Yeah. When have we ever needed Christian cowboys before? We needed them in Tibet. You know? And yet, I don't know if anyone ever mobilized Christian cowboys before then. But they're a horse culture, and so, and you know, they had so many limits, but they would do a culture exchange on riding and demonstrating horse, you know, roping and all those kind of things. So they brought them over, and there was an absolute connection and a breakthrough. So, I mean, anything can be used. Anything can be used, and it's amazing. And when I talk to professionals or, you know, people in their work, about their work life, most of them will end up, if they ever understand what I'm saying, they'll end up saying, I've always felt like I wanted God to use me and use my skills for more than just bringing home a paycheck. So it's in our hearts. We just didn't know it applied. Yeah. Okay, anything else? Okay.
How could we find information to take back to our churches of like the list, maybe a list of skills that are needed or something?
Well, really, I don't know of anywhere there's a list, but I can tell you that just understanding the countries and what they're grappling with will, for instance, see, I used to, my husband and I were one who committed, or so, I mean, we actually volunteered for the field. My husband was an incredible, mechanical design engineer. He has some amazing patents. If you've ever been fed by an intravenous feeding bottle in a hospital, your life has been saved because of him. Because that little trap in the middle, they were getting contamination and it was killing people. And that little trap in the middle of that line is what he designed. So he's been gone now almost 22 years. He passed away at 45. But we committed ourselves to the field, and we weren't accepted, and this is the reason. One is the way you had to take a job on the public list, you know, of the agency. And in order for us to qualify, my husband would have to quit his job with three children, go back to seminary for 4 years, and then pastor successfully for 2 years. And let me tell you, my husband was not a pastor. I don't think he had any mercy gifts at all. But by then, we still couldn't go because our oldest child would be too old, and then they wouldn't send us. So we wrongly concluded that we couldn't go. Okay? Now, with what I know now, I realize we could have, but we didn't know that. And so our traditional ways of getting missionaries to the field is to go through an agency door with the published list. Today, I can walk into any city in the world, and I can tell you I probably have 5 or 10 opportunities in one day. Because all of the requests were based on felt needs, you know, things that are obvious. But I want to tell you that 95% of the actual opportunities on their field are unperceived needs. For instance, I have a friend went into Turkey several years ago, was talking with some shepherds and some vineyard keepers, and because he had some relatives that actually were in the Fresno area of California and had vineyards, he realized that some of their planning, I mean their processes were just really old. And so he talked to them and said, you know, if we could double your yield every year, would you be open to having some people, and this was in an area where they would not allow missionaries, but would you be interested in having some people that would come and help you? He came back and mobilized some vineyard keepers, Christian vineyard keepers in the Fresno area, took them over, and in 3 weeks, not only, from what I understand, they probably increased their yield much more than double, and went through a lot of the cultural things and formed friendships that have now resulted in some conversions in a place. And so, see, the shepherds would have never known, or the vineyard keepers would have never known to say, we need this. They would have never said that. So it would have never been, quote, a published opportunity. But you can go in and you see things as professionals. You see, you know, well, they don't even know that this is available. But this could really help, whatever it is, in almost every profession. So I would say 95% of the actual opportunities on the field are behind closed doors. I mean, they're behind hidden doors. You would never see them published. Actually, they say about 85% of jobs that you get in America are never published in the Sunday newspaper. It's through a friend. See, it's hidden doorways in. It's not the public doorway in. And so most of our mobilization and missions has been done in the public doorways through the mission, through the agency. Most of the opportunities are actually through hidden doorways.
Can you talk about, I'm affirming if you're, let's say, the accountant need in China, but and even if you got a sweet group of accountants to come together and go to China, now where do you think that, I mean, and hopefully if those accountants are walking closely with the Lord, they can lead accountants in China to Christ, but then what about next steps, like church planting movements or house, you know, like, because most accountants, they may be really good accountants, they don't have a clue about seeing an explosion of...
That's a great question. What we find in all the research is that if a professional can do three things, four things really, if they can build a bridge of friendship across a cultural boundary, if they can lead a person to faith, and if they can start a small group through that person, and then watch for the new converts and teach them to do the same things, they can be a church planter. In fact, we find that some of them have started the best church planting movements going on in the world. It's been through professionals. And but where do they get that skill? And so that's why I've got a three-pronged approach to, the rest of my life, and I am working with senior pastors, because if the church is the only place they can get those skills. And they're not going to quit their jobs and go to seminary. And seminaries, even if they went, wouldn't train them to do that. And so it can all be in the local laboratory, that equipping. And then if a person is equipped for that, then they're such a blessing locally too. And so that's why we focused with all of our people just on, can you, you know, get in and grow and reproduce small groups. And so, again, if you can do that, it takes very little ministry skill. What we did was, within the church context, there's ways in which the scripture calls all believers to grow through, you know, reading the word and through fellowship and through witnessing and things. But we always paid attention to the other two sides. One is the ministry side, where they're getting the right kind of experience in ministry to do basic ministry. And then the other side that we looked at was where are they in their jobs, and are they credible? Are they excellent? You know, because we were really looking for credible people. So we were trying to help them on the job side too, with any kind of advanced education they needed or anything. So I believe that's in the hands of the local church. But if the pastor doesn't get it, it's not going to happen. And so we are working with a network of churches that are really helping churches get this down. Yeah. So. Pardon me? It's really interesting. Yeah, most people don't have the kind of influence or credibility. Pastors listen to pastors, and they listen to their wife and their teenage kids. And that's about it for the most part. And so that's why we've been working with this network of pastors that get it, and they're influencing the other pastors. Yeah. And so you can, for instance, I have two things. If you're a regular person in the church, you can do things anywhere you have a role, an official capacity, you initiate. Anywhere you don't have a role, you influence. And the way you influence is through serving. For instance, I have worked with some people who have wanted their pastor to come on board, and they have done things like pay their way to go on a short-term trip, and just because the guy wanted to travel to some exotic place or some fun place, he went, never knowing that God was going to encounter him there. And sometimes it just doesn't work. But in other words, you serve in ways. A lot of times if you can get their wife on a trip or their teenagers to take perspectives, again, they will influence. So you just use as many things as you can. Our conference is for, the one part is for senior pastors, and we've got a group of seven pastors who really get this and who really are global local churches, and they're disproportionately effective on the field and at home to the size of their budgets, to the size of their congregations, and they are very impactful to pastors. So if there's any way you can get your pastors there, I guarantee they won't leave the same. So one of the things we're finding, and this will be in our business track of the thing, is we're finding that what you have to do is go into an area and you have to figure out kind of what are the giants that are keeping the people in bondage and in captivity spiritually. So, you know, and I mean, it could be economically and everything else. And typically in unreached areas, it's things like housing, clean water, and these kind of things. And what we've found is you have to start a cluster of businesses that are capable of reproducing. For instance, if you do housing kinds of business, then that kicks off things like plumbing and electrical and sawmills and all kinds of stuff. So you're looking at the core group of businesses you can start that's going to multiply and have the ability to actually have impact on people too. There's some things you can start where you don't have much connection with people. That's not a good kind of business to start if you're on mission. And so those are some things that we have discovered is you need a cluster usually to make very much impact. The other thing I would really recommend that he do is talk to some people who have started some businesses in China already, and they have recommendations. I'll give you, for instance, there's a friend of mine. He and his wife both graduated from Stanford, and he's in medical devices. He's an engineer. So they started a company. He had been a perspectives coordinator, and now he was trying to be intentional. So what they did was they chose an unreached city. They chose one of these 87 cities that I talked about. We gave them the list. They began to pray. But they wanted a city that to put their manufacturing, and they decided to put the manufacturing in China instead of here. For mission purposes. So they chose a city that was unreached, and they worked with several agencies to see who would get a strategy coordinator in there so that they had some partners in there, because they had the ability to hire locals and some things like that. So again, he's been very intentional about what he's doing, but he's partnering with some people that can get the church started and that sort of thing. So I'd be glad to give you some names of people you can talk to. Another friend has started 17 manufacturing businesses, and there's just almost no way to make money with a business in China, so you have to really get some, because the government has things stacked against you. They will tell you the world, but they don't deliver and some things like that. So you need somebody that's wise in terms of doing business in China. Yeah. Okay, let's go on. I want to just show you some things as we talk about kingdom professionals. I believe there's some synergistic components that are needed if you're going to mobilize professionals. But these tips will help you with mobilizing anyone, okay? But some synergistic components. I believe that you need attuned activators, and that's you. You need a catalytic message, and you need a distinctive process. Now, the reason I say attuned activators is you have to be attuned to what God's doing, and you have to be attuned to everywhere you go, whoever you're talking to, because you never know when there's going to be an opportunity. It doesn't happen in set meetings. I can tell you that almost all of it happens in very informal ways as you go, because you're not just waiting for meetings for it to happen, even though you may have the advantage of that too. But you must be attuned to both what God's doing in the world, and you must be attuned to, you know, who you're with and what kind of capacities they bring. For instance, I was with a group of churches in El Paso, Texas a few years ago. And the more we looked at this and began to understand who they were, because I had never been to El Paso. And I knew they were a borderland city, but I had no clue what that meant in terms of everyday life. But I soon learned. Because they, a borderland city lives very different than any other city. They live across an international border, and there's back and forth every day. So it's just not like other cities. Well, in a whole series of conversations and meetings that they had, they eventually activated all the borderland cities of the world in the unreached area, in the 1040 window. But we discovered that, and it was just because I was asking about the borderland city, and I began to think, so I said, well, are there some other borderland cities? They began to name some. So I said, well, which ones are in the unreached world, the 1040? Well, they didn't know all of them, but they began to study. And then they learned that there's five kinds of borderland cities. You know, one is where there's hostile governments, you know, on both sides. And anyway, all this sort of thing. So they adopted all the borderland cities that were like their borderland cities in the 1040 window. You see what I'm saying? So it's like you never know where a conversation is going to go. So you must be attuned because God is wanting to use you. I believe you also need a catalytic message, and we're going to talk about that in a distinctive process. I can tell you that most mission talks or mission reports, I've sat through more boring ones than I care to think about. And if your message is pretty boring, let me just say it's not catalytic. It's not going to do much. If you're just doing the should thing and the need thing, that's not very catalytic with your generation or even in our culture today. And so I believe these are three things that need to be a part of that. I believe that in your message you need to build a bridge from their interest or their capacity to what God's doing. And so I see myself as building bridges. I'm trying to help them understand what God's doing as it relates to who they are, what they're interested in, and what their capacity is. I was in a meeting in Houston, Texas last Friday, and a young woman talked to me, and she was trying to get interested in missions. She was interested in missions, couldn't figure even out what to take in school, so she dropped out of school this year because she couldn't figure out. Well, within about 3 minutes, we figured out what her real passion is, and it's design, clothing design. But she says, but that doesn't fit with missions, and everyone's told me, no, I need to take something else in school. But see, I knew a clothing designer that won all kinds of awards in clothing design. She was a part of our church. She moved to New York City. She began to get jobs. She's incredible. She began to get jobs with Calvin Klein and other things. But on the side, because she was a believer who understood the calling to the world, she began to make some connections in India with some people there that could be manufacturing, and she began to take trips over. And so on the side, while she had all these highfalutin paying jobs, she was also creating her future business. And it was a partnership with India, because India is kind of where she wanted to devote her life. And so out of that conversation last Friday, I'm able to hook her up with B, you know, who already has some experience along this line, is being used incredibly as a high fashion designer for the sake of the gospel. So nothing is really off limits. And so I just try to find out who God's made him to be and connect that. And then I believe that we have to use language that crosses to an understanding barrier to a mission illiterate Christian. Now, if you just talk about missions, in fact, I almost don't use the word missions anymore, because I find that what that does for most Christians is it just says, oh, that's not who I am. And you ask them if they want to go on a short-term trip, if they want to be a missionary, the answer is no. But if you start talking to them about what they enjoy doing, I'll give you another example. I have three sons, and two of them used to just love to play basketball every Saturday morning at a park and with some of their friends. And one day their car was not working, and so they had asked me if I could pick them up, and I went over a little early, and I'm standing there watching all these kids, and not one of these kids came to our mission conferences. They weren't interested in missions. They weren't interested in short-term trips. They'd had ample opportunity, never gone. But I watched them, and I knew that in China at that moment, there were groups going over just to play friendship games in these places that were totally unreached. And so I just went up. I didn't ask them if they wanted to go on a short-term trip. I said, hey, you guys, I said, would you guys be interested in going as a team over to a city in China and playing basketball? One is to teach them basketball because they're interested in learning, and just play some friendship games. And I'll tell you who will show up. It'll be the mayor and, you know, the equivalent of the mayor and the city officials. They'll play with you. And you'll have an opportunity to share your testimony and some things like that and talk about America and do a little cultural, you know, explaining what Americans do and things. Would you be interested? Absolutely. Now, if I'd asked them if they wanted to go on a mission trip, the answer would have been no. But did they, you know, they go on a mission trip? Yes. Did things get done kingdom-wise? Yes. So you have to use language. You have to know your audience and use language that crosses this understanding barrier, because we really do have mission illiterate Christians. And then you must envision the person's unique contribution to God's purposes. So help them get an idea of who they are. Just like I gave you the story of the Yale professor. He never had a clue that God wanted to use him in some pretty powerful ways. And so your message, I believe these are three components of a message that becomes very catalytic. It engages people. It activates people. And then I believe you have to have a distinctive process. And And I'm not saying these just have to all be in order, but I think some components of these things really have to be there. One, you have to seed the heart. You know, it's not just a head decision and things. It's like you have to help people understand where other people are and understand what God's doing, understand this incredible story of God that he's really wanting to move, and how when God comes in, everything changes. And so you have to seed the heart. It's not about going on a trip or doing a project. It's about being a part of what God's doing and literally destiny and shaping the kingdom. So that's really where it is. So you must seed the heart. You must go after the real bottom line. And then we find that people today need multiple options of next steps. If you don't have multiple options and ways to get in, I can tell you that a lot of agency and a lot of... I don't know how your group does it, but a lot of student groups, they have one process, one option. It's to go for 2 months, or it's to go for 2 weeks, and it's to go on these 2 weeks. And I tell you what, if you do that, you just simply limit how many can go. But if you have multiple options, multiple weeks, multiple doorways in, that really does open up to a lot more people. So, or this kind of a process, and you have to get it at these meetings in this way, in this time frame. There has to be multiple ways to even get the training sometime. Now, obviously, you're going to have to all come together at some point. But multiple options is really critical for this culture that we're in today. And then you have to have accessible and specific equipping. People tend to get courage to move when they know they're going to be equipped for what they're going to experience. And so it must be accessible to them. And sometime, for instance, we experiment a lot because we have a commuter culture here in L.A. So a lot of our equipping was, we called them commuter tapes. They were tapes that you listened to, and then we got together and dialogued on what you learned. So we took less time in the meeting together. We didn't do all the presentation there, but we did commuter tapes that everybody listens to, and then you can get further faster. So you have to have it accessible for their lifestyle, and it has to be specific for what they're going to do. And then mutual mentoring. We are in a day of mutual mentoring. In ministry, we've typically talked down to people. We've typically, you know, we're here to tell you what you need to do. We're here to help you do it. I want to tell you we're in a day of mutual mentoring, because I have as much to learn from professionals as they have need to connect with my connections to get there. Does that make sense? And so I'm always learning. I'm always trying to understand from that person's viewpoint. And for instance, I regularly interview my grandsons. I have 4 grandsons, 11, 13, 18, and 19. And I even will invite them and 3 or 4 of their friends out so that I can interview them. I do that about twice a year. Because I want to know what's going on in the thinking of that age group. And I can tell you, I have a lot of voice with them. They love to go with me because I need them. And I really get a long way, again, with a lot of professionals because I don't understand their field, but I'm always trying to. And so out of the things they tell me, we even shape it better. So be sure and make sure it's a give and take with people that you're working with, trying to understand exactly what it is they're dealing with. Let me mention some conversational topics that I believe that mobilizers need to be having. And so among you, I think these are some of the critical things for mobilizers today. For instance, one of the things is mobilize churches and believers are going to non-strategic places. They're duplicating efforts and they're hindering the move of the Spirit of God. I'm called into churches quite often, and I can tell you that one of the best mission churches in America I was called to, and discovered that not only were they going to places where the gospel already is, they were spending tons of money doing it. I'm just going to tell you about one church that was like this, and they're well known for their missions efforts. And I found out that they, the mission pastor and a couple of their people had sat through a perspectives course. So they asked if they could talk to me, and this is what I discovered. Their biggest event of the year is going to a city in Mexico, and they take money, they take materials, clothing, food, and they build houses or a church building. Now, the more I investigated and asked questions, I realized that this city is the same city that 500 other churches go to every year in America doing their mission projects. It's a city right across the border. And in this city, there has never been a real move of the Spirit of God. And yet all these churches go down with clothing, food, and build houses and buildings. And what I finally realized is this is a welfare city. It's a welfare city of American Christians doing missions that come back and report these amazing things and feel good about what they're doing. But this particular church, is they spend $42,000 a year of their mission budget. And they take 175 men, and they come back and they use two whole services to report on the things. And the more we began to look at things, the more they realized this is not very strategic. It's not accomplishing the mission of God in this place. It's not becoming Christian. But they love having the teams come down because they're on our welfare system. And they said if we took this out, we would be kicked out of our positions. Because this is the hottest thing the church does all year. Now, I believe that we need to be talking about this issue, because I can tell you most churches are right now doing very non-strategic things with their funds and their time and their people. And they're duplicating efforts and they're hindering the move of God. Tomorrow, some things you'll learn, you'll see the hindering part. Okay, I'm not going to go into that tonight. I think we need to be talking about the fact that there are system gaps. From the point of interest of a person, and even sometimes commitment to the field, there is a huge gap. And I found that almost all my mobilization is focused not on getting interest, but it's on helping people make it. And I can tell you that more than 19 out of 20 people don't make it that feel called. And that's not any kind of official survey. That's my survey from people I've kind of worked with. And so most of the mobilization effort goes into this connecting piece that keeps them connected and moving. And one of the ways we did that in our church was I met with the women, and one of the men met with the guys every quarter just to talk about the movement, talk about the progress in their move toward the field. So mobilization doesn't stop with the interest and the commitment. It stops when they get to the field. And I think we need to be talking about how to do that gap better, because that's the skills that most mobilizers don't have. And it's what takes the most energy, and it's what really wears you out. Because most mobilizers, their attitude is, well, God called them to the field, and most agencies' attitudes is, if God called them to the field, they'll make it. In other words, the initiative needs to be on them. And I'm just saying, if we're really going to help people, I believe they need help in that gap. Some other is the difference in ethnic and age group distinctives. In other words, they respond to different things. They have a different set of challenges and issues. The different age groups, they have whole different needs. They respond to different things. And they can actually contribute different things. The ethnic groups, same thing. For instance, Asians, I mean, they have incredible family and cultural pressure. One of the gals I was working with, her parents told her, and these were very committed Christians who had helped start churches and everything here, and yet they told their daughter that if she went to the field that she would kill their grandmother when she found out, and that they would kick her out. And the parents said, and so we will not, because you would create so much problem for your grandmother, we will not own you anymore. You will no longer be part of our family. There is incredible pressure. Again, different ethnic groups, they have whole different sets of issues. I believe as mobilizers, we have to understand these and know how to deal with them. Safety and security issues have been a big conversation topic for those considering the field today. And so if you don't have answers, and if you don't understand that we're calling people to the very front lines of the battlefield, and it's very dangerous there, and God has said we had to go, and he never said we had to come back, and that we're going to have suffering, we're going to have martyrdom, and we know that when people go, someday somebody's not going to come back, okay? So that's just, I mean, that's the facts of life. It is in every field that has been a major move of God, there's always suffering, and many times martyrdom. We don't take new territory away from the evil one. and call people from darkness to light and not pay a price. So I believe that you have to have a theological basis for this. You have to be real and you have to be understand. I think we're not talking enough about it. And so I just see so many trying to promise safety. And I don't even believe we should be leading toward people toward safety, because where people are the most unreached and the most receptive is where it's the most dangerous. After 911, more than three-quarters of the teams going out that next summer were pulled back within the first 2 weeks. When the people that were the most open, the church pulled back. Okay? I believe that we need to be discussing leverage and mechanisms for mobilization. How do we leverage what's already there? In other words, let me give you, for instance, with a perspectives class. I've heard several of you say you want to go back and do perspectives classes. You know, every perspectives class that I know of, they set this year's dates, and then people are all charged up. Oh, my friends really need to get this. My family needs to come. But they don't have next year's date set. They don't sign them up now. And so then next spring, they try to get them interested in inviting their friends, and the fire's gone. So you haven't leveraged the passion and the ignite. You need to have next year's date set right now so they go get their friends. And there's other ways you can leverage the movement that's already there. We're just letting it die. And so we're not getting the kind of leverage and movement we need to. And the mechanisms for actually processing. And so I believe we have to have conversations about this. Let me give you an idea of a mechanism. When we took trips, short-term trips as a congregation, one of the things that I did every trip was one day was devoted to those who were going to go to the equivalent of their professional area in that city, and their only job was to find needs. So if you're an educator, you go to the schools. If you're a banker, you go to the banks. If you're a you can go on healthcare, you go to the hospitals. And you're just there as a visitor to see how things are going and if there's any way we could help meet your needs. And that's their only job that day. Well, out of that, what happens is, because they've now invested in discovering needs, many of them would come back and they would begin to meet needs and I would never even know they were doing it. Or many times they planned and they met someone, they carried on, they began to get help to them in these areas. And many times even then committed to the field and went back long term. Now that's an idea of a leverage point and a mechanism. The mechanism was one day on a short term trip to go to your domain area. Does that make sense? So that's all we did, was just put that in. So there's all kinds of mechanisms that can be put in place. And then conversational topics. I really believe this whole issue of the domains and the professions needs to be addressed it even far more than we've done it tonight. Now, what time do you have? Okay, I'm fast. So, there's a man, his name is Ed Dayton, just passed away in the last couple of years, and he and Ted Engstrom, who ran World Vision for a number of years, wrote an article in a magazine for leadership many years ago. And they told the story of a manufacturing company. And this manufacturing company, the man who had started it and who had been there all his life was getting ready to retire, the owner. And so there was a lot of conversation going on among the men who had worked for him for many years, and they were trying to figure out, okay, who's he going to promote to leadership, you know, when he retires, and trying to figure that out. And when the day came for him to announce, they were absolutely floored, because he said that his son, a young man who had just graduated from college, who had never spent a day in the manufacturing company, he was going to take over. And they figured, what did this kid, wet behind the ears, doesn't know anything about this company, you know, what in the world is he going to do? And their suspicions were confirmed in the first big meeting where they were planning for next year. And the kid was sitting there kind of slopped over the back of his chair while all the old hands were discussing. It was in a time when there were the economic downturn in the States and the projections for next year didn't look too good. And so they were discussing, how are we going to get more of the market for, it was a drill bit company, how can we get more of the market for drill bits next year? And so they continued talk, so they were planning strategy, how they could capture more of that market and survive another year. And finally, the young kid said, the world doesn't want drill bits. And, you know, they now their suspicions were confirmed. He didn't know anything. But he let it go on for a little while, and he finally said, the world doesn't want drill bits. What the world wants is holes. That discussion then led to the first use of laser technology for drilling holes, because they finally got the question right. What does the world want? And so what I want to suggest to you tonight is that the questions you ask and answer will determine destiny. Are you asking the right questions? And I'm not going to go into a long thing, but I would just suggest that if you really want to be used in this area of mobilization, not God, will you bless our mobilization plans, or, you know, God, would you allow me to mobilize so many people, but God, how do you want to change me or us so that you can work through us this year? What needs to change in me? Because he works far more in terms of not as much skill, but who we are with him. And so asking him how he wants to change you. Not so much how can I get this student on a pathway to the field, but how can I build the bridge from who he is to what God is doing right now? That's, I think, a more appropriate question. Hopefully the things we've talked about tonight will help you in terms of the things that God will lead you to. I'd like for each of you just to think for a moment about one thing that you feel like you take away from tonight. You say to the Lord, if I don't do anything except this, or if I don't ask this question, or if I don't really figure this piece out, you know, I don't know how much further I can move in this. But I'd like for you to identify one thing that you just want to kind of focus down on and you want to ask God to do in your life. And then I want you just to neighbor nudge and two of you share with each other. So just one-on-one, okay? And I'll close in prayer in just a few moments.
To find out more, visit www.thetravelingteam.org.